Hi, Jesse. How you doing?
Man, I'm okay for a guy trapped in a box.
Still in the box.
Man in the box.
What was that?
Alice in Chains.
Yeah. That song? Was it Man? I thought it was
Man in the Box.
Oh, I'm thinking the song was Down in a Hole. I never really got into Alice in Chains, but I feel like they were a musician's band.
To me, they were just a metal band.
Yeah, you didn't find them like especially skilled.
No, I thought they were great musicians.
Their songs were difficult. That was when I was trying to learn guitar, and I was pulling out like tablatures, and so I ended up learning like Hootie and the Blowfish rather than Alice in Chains.
Yeah, that's where you went down the dark. You went to the dark side with Hootie.
I just wanted to play, man.
That's why I stopped playing guitar, because I was trying to learn how to play Rush, you know, songs. I'm like, this is way beyond my skill level. Maybe I need to just go play some drums.
Some Hootie.
No, I never wanted to play, and nor will I ever.
I mean, I didn't start until I was 16, so I was like,
I didn't start playing drums until I was about 14, 15.
Yeah, but I wanted to sing.
You wanted to impress girls.
Sadly, that was not part. It should have been. I mean, it ended up being one of the reasons why my wife wanted to be with me. But
I don't want to be you.
I actually won her over with a equally simple song, Semisonic, Closing Time.
They were great.
Mm.
Oh, man, he's a great songwriter. You ever listen to solo records?
I don't even know who you're talking about.
You know, they were older by the time they hit, and he's a really good songwriter. You should check him out.
I've heard people like try to give layers to that song that I'm talking about, Closing Time. It's like about his kid or something. I didn't ever go that far into it, which sounds like something I would get into, but yeah. I never did. I just know it as a very simple guitar riff that I was able to learn.
The production on it is great.
On what? That song?
That whole album.
But a child could play it.
Yeah. Yeah, the song's simple. But yeah, I'm talking about like the actual record, the recording.
I need to get back on it. Maybe that can be one of our album reviews, is like the best album of the 90s in like that genre. All right, well, along those lines, would you rather be an amazing virtuoso at any instrument, but only if you played naked, because your power only happened when you were undressed?
Right.
Or speak any language, but only if you close your eyes and dance while you're speaking?
I think I would rather be able to speak any language and close my eyes and dance, because that sounds about right for me.
Do you feel like you have more applications if it was a dancing?
Yeah, I think I could probably pull that off a little bit.
You could be the cool professor in that sense.
Well, his class dances. Yeah, his class is odd. He moves around a lot, but man, he can speak like 12 languages. Naked drummer? Nah, that's just going to creep everybody out. Or naked guitar player? You'd have to have that thing slung really low.
There's been someone, I mean, if Flea could just be in his underwear.
Well, they wore the socks. Remember that cover of Rolling Stone where they all had like the socks on their nail parts? Yeah.
I think there's a world now that you could be the naked virtuoso and it would be just fine.
Can I just say for the record that I'm a never nude?
Are you Tobias?
I subscribe to the never nude philosophy.
Do you have a pair of cutoff jeans underneath?
Probably. Maybe. You'll never know. You know, for like the longest time, I wouldn't wear shorts.
I'm always surprised to see you in shorts. Like,
it's
right
been
now.
A relative like new phase of my life, I think.
To show your legs?
I'm like, short pants are what children wear. For children.
Right.
I like to cover my skin. I want to keep it.
That's fair enough. I probably will die of skin cancer. But I'm also not spending my life in misery because I've chose to wear skinny jeans to the beach. So you're choosing the language. That's interesting. I kind of would have thought you had chosen the other, because you don't seem all that modest to me in general. Honestly, I think I would probably choose the naked one, because I'm so inhibited in like dancing and stuff and singing. I mean, I know I do that, but it still is such a hard thing for me. And so like getting up in front of people and having to perform in order to be like magnificent at something.
But you're in your birthday suit?
I don't really care all that much what people think of me. And I think I would get creative in a way to do that, to where, you know, I was like very well endowed and I could use some.
See, the problem
prisms
is,
and things like that.
Prisms. Light show, smoke. The problem with modern society is that modesty is not a thing. That's one of the reasons I don't like going to the beach. Like, I just don't like, I don't want to see all that flesh. I don't care if your body is quote unquote perfect. I should have lived during like the early 1900s, maybe. Steampunk. I want to wear like a top hat and a monocle. I like clothes. I want to wear a lot of clothes.
The ladies are like
yeah, 14 layers of petticoats and brassieres and corsets.
God, I can't imagine how hot that would be.
Oh, man. See, to me, that's hot. That is hot to me. I'm like, girl, go on, peel that brassiere off.
Hello again, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Two Americas. We are still doing this after now 3 months. I was looking back. We started this back in June. I know we've taken a good bit of time off here recently, but the fact that we've kind of tried to figure some things out, keep this thing going, and the fact that you guys continue to ask us when we are not doing things, we don't hear that we have a podcast. What are you doing?
There's a bug in my cage.
Jesse's like, he's at the zoo. He's touching the plexiglass. It's like a child was here and holding their hand up to the side. He is reaching out and there's a scientist somewhere saying he's trying to communicate with the child.
Oh my gosh. That's kind of racist.
Why is that racist?
Man, because of just the context of white people, like, you know, saying that blacks are animals and stuff.
Am I going to have to say this every episode? Why you're in the cage?
No. But didn't we have a conversation where you like open your phone? There was like 35 text messages between me, you, your wife, and my wife.
Yes.
The bulk of them were about how like I could make anything racist.
Yes. Everyone agreed that no one was saying anything racist but you. Okay. But actually, to your credit, that is, you are the only black person in that conversation. So you have a unique ability to determine whether something is racist. Or
racist man, able to spot racism 100 miles away. Racist man.
There's a lot of those, right? Like pretty much anyone that's black.
Maybe. It's racist, man.
That's a positive thing. That's a thing that is unique to the black experience. You're able to identify in a way that, frankly, I'm not able to identify it. Yeah. But we're listening. We're having the conversation. And that's what we're doing here. And we are extending this conversation. I have to say it now that you made it about race. Jesse is in a cage.
I'm not in a cage, actually. I'm in a plexiglass sound booth of sorts.
I can't be in one because I'm operating the computer. I can't.
You get to be out there in free land. Put that wild animal drummer black guy in the booth.
Okay. All right. I have to man the computer and I have to be more mobile. And so I can't put myself in the plexiglass.
I know.
We're trying to isolate sound and be conscious of health standards being in the same space.
It makes me feel comfortable, actually.
And you're used to being in plexiglass. Because those of you that don't know, drummers end up in plexiglass
when they play in white churches and black churches now too.
Pretty much all plexiglass does is just kind of, it still goes over the top and it just bounces to the back and creates some like
it just
a delayed,
makes me feel, it makes a delay, like I can't really hear. What you need to learn how to do, future percussionists and drummers, is learn how to play quieter so they don't make you play in the plexiglass.
Yeah,
because it isolates you.
I heard Dave Grohl, so he learned to play drums like on his bed hitting pillows.
Oh yeah, which is great exercise because that teaches you to have a really good technique because the pillow doesn't give.
But he's also talking about how that made him hit so hard.
He's a basher. Yeah.
Yeah. So he wouldn't be, you know, or you can just join a rock band, just bang away.
Well, yeah. I mean, that worked for him.
But don't go getting into folk rock
or jazz or Thundercat.
Yeah, we're done with Thundercat, man. We are done with Thundercat. Jazz, I don't know jazz really at all. We don't really talk about jazz. How much of your time you play jazz?
Not much. I'd love to play more. Probably play more than I think, though. A lot of these private events I do, they have jazz sets sometimes before the actual banquet, you know, reception starts. So I get to play, you know, just kind of...
Sort of feeding off each other, right?
No, we actually play like standard jazz tunes.
Okay,
like,
so we'll play stuff out.
Yeah, we'll play stuff out of what musicians call the real book. And it's just a bunch of standards.
So how many people playing jazz are actually learning a song rather than playing off of ear?
Oh, man, like all these guys I play with in that context, a couple of them are actually jazz professors.
So there's still a degree of improvisation.
Oh, during the solo, but yeah, I play with a lot of like serious jazz musician. That's like what they teach or what they studied in music school. Yeah, I mean, I consider myself to be a jazz musician or have a jazz context or view of music.
Yeah, me too. Hootie was considered jazz, right?
I was going to say something. Man, good for Darius Rucker. That brother, he found his niche.
Hey, and speaking of, that's another very difficult environment to stand up in, and he stood up.
That's what I mean. Like, yeah, good for him.
Yeah.
You know, they only let one black guy be country every 30 years. Charlie Pride kind of, he's still alive. Mm-hmm. Darius is like, he exploited that. Seriously, Corey, a few years ago, I really was like, I need to go to Nashville and put on a hat and like stand there and sing. There are a couple of black guys. They're out doing that. They're not hit artist yet.
Yeah.
We played some festival, I think, up in Anniston, this band I was in. The headliner was this guy, I can't remember his name, but he was like a black guy with a cowboy hat. Yeah. And it was legit.
Is he playing those odds like that they need? Is it playing the marketing?
I didn't talk to him.
Or is he, do you feel like he's really like, this is what I do. I'm a country guy.
I think it's a little of both. I mean, he was more one of those hybrid, I like 90s country, but I'm going to wear a cowboy hat on my album cover. But when you see me, I got my Eric Church baseball hat on and I'm a working class, you know, but all the songs kind of sounded like top 40 country.
Well, what's interesting as we move into this topic of sports, like it's interesting, the kind of the balance of athletes, we're extending kind of not exactly the conversation that we had last week, but still some things we touched on. As a black athlete, there's sort of, I guess maybe it's a critique. I was reading a bunch of stuff about this just in research, and some people who are black would criticize some of the players for kind of becoming or assimilating, I guess, and sort of playing to the way the system works rather than, and you contrast that with somebody like a Kaepernick or someone who is kind of announcing their blackness and taking that as their position or their place in that world to kind of define some of the, you know, injustices and things that would not be brought up from players that maybe would have assimilated a little bit more. And I think that's true with probably every occupation. It'd be the true with music. Yeah. So it's an interesting question of like, whose role is that? Is that every black person's role to take a stand and to make it about something, frankly, to become a martyr? Because that's exactly
what happened to Kaepernick. Yeah. He will forever be remembered as the guy who stood up and said, no more, you know, I'm going to stand for something. But it cost him his career. I mean, I don't follow football a lot, but I read the news and I know that he's just never going to get to play. I mean, he's pretty much.
Well, apparently there's somebody looking at him now.
Yeah, there's always somebody looking at him, but I think he had a really bad like tryout not too long ago. Man, it's complex, Corey. Like anything dealing with racial matters, not everybody can afford to stand up and take a stand. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that they don't support it. You know, I've heard older, like when we talked to my mom, she wasn't out there in the streets. That wasn't her thing. She wasn't. But I mean, of course she supported the ideas and the movement. Mm-hmm. That's what you have to understand is that in order to move forward, some people just kind of have to maintain the status quo while others become martyrs or sacrificial lambs. Mm-hmm. That's just the way of progress. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, sometimes those who aren't out there in the front and being very vocal are seen as maybe assimilationist or, you know, not seen as being down. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Well, you know, I heard Morgan Freeman, because one thing that's happening, especially in the anti-Black Lives Matter side, you'll see this, especially on social media, finding clips or people saying something like black people saying, why are we making this about race? Something that was probably this would Morgan Freeman was, I don't know how long ago, but someone like him who has really arrived in a way inside of a system. I mean, Hollywood is white generally. I mean, it's like, I think 5% of the directors in Hollywood, I think is what I read, currently are people of color. Like it's very, very white. That's the system that he's operating in. And to succeed in that, there's a level of things you probably aren't going to challenge, right?
For sure.
He made a point in this interview of saying the reason that there's racism is because we keep talking about racism.
Yeah, I saw that interview. I didn't agree with him.
Yeah, I didn't agree with that either. It seemed like an oversimplification. It also seemed like something that only a person who has that kind of privilege would be able to say.
Then I think at the end of it, he kind of brought it back around. I mean, he made his point, but I was just like, yeah, like you said, that's an oversimplification. I'm like, not everybody has the access or not everybody has that chance to rise. And I know that he came from a background that was not.
He came from a poor background.
Yeah, I understand that whole like if you work hard. But see, that's not always the case, is it? I don't know what to say sometimes if people are like, you know, don't make it about race.
Yeah, there have been a lot of first steps in sports for like racial, like to set the tone for some things to come. And we talked about that a little bit last week with how good coaches and people who are kind of in the mix with people with diversity and they listen and they're able to be a positive influence for change. I think that the people who then succeed in those worlds they're kind of faced with that question of what do you then do with your platform? And a lot of people have done that really well. Like I think, in my opinion anyway, if you do speak up, you're going to take a hit in some way. You're going to take a hit. And I think that will endear you to some people and it's going to push you away from some other people. And so I think, again, back to just kind of more personality. Like some people may just not want to get into that part of it and just be who they are, just be an athlete and not have to get into the politics of it all. And does that mean they're wrong? I don't think that means that they're wrong. But I think, do you think it takes a very special someone who would be willing to put that stuff on the line?
I think you have to get to a certain place in your career or your status as an entertainer or athlete or whatever your occupation is. A lot of times you can't step out of line until you know that if I do this, I'll still be all right. Kaepernick, like I said, that move he made, that was a sacrificial move because he wasn't at a place yet to where he could be like, I'm going to be okay.
Right. He wasn't LeBron saying that.
Yeah. For LeBron to speak up like, yeah, LeBron, you're the man.
And why is that? Why is he the man? Because
he's made all the money. Yeah. He's had the championships right. And he's got his loyal, you know, contingency of fans and supporters. So it's a little bit easier for LeBron to take a hit. You know what I mean? But for like Kaepernick, just well, like,
and he was prior to a lot of this stuff too. So the NFL has, you know, made statements to say that they have
finally they've been the slowest ones.
They have been the slowest ones. Yeah. It's not insignificant that happened. There's still a lot of things in that culture and all the sports cultures, I'm sure, but it does seem to be the slower one with Major League Baseball, which I want to talk about sports a little more. So MLB, which is the logo, and on the televised versions of these games, it looked like it would have been MLB, the logo, but instead it said BLM. And I thought, man, that is like, you got people who think that BLM is like a terrorist organization. Yeah. And here you have this massive industry supporting it to the point that they're rearranging the letters of their logo in order to support the cause. It's sad that it takes a martyr to do that, but I do think that there's a lot of things that have shifted because a few people have chosen to stand up inside of that.
It's so contentious sometimes when you do make a statement changing the logo. Some people just want to watch baseball. Mm-hmm. And so then they get irate and they're like, oh, now we're just making everything about race.
Right.
But see, that's the problem, is that everything in this country is about race. It really is. Unfortunately, we're a unique country. And the fact that we got a lot of work to do, you know, because we ascribe to all these ideas and ideals that we've never really been able to live up to because we haven't dealt with our own dirty laundry. Mm-hmm. And so when people are like, yeah, everybody's making everything about race. Well, yeah, because it's not been dealt with.
But it's not been dealt with on such a massive scale as it is right now. In my opinion, I feel like it feels like it's coming from a lot of different angles.
And that's good. I mean, that's a good thing to me, because in order to make a change in society, it needs to be something that people are conscious of. That to me has been the problem in the past with a lot of movements and things, is that it would kind of crop up and people be like, oh yeah. And then it would kind of fade away. This is just like, it's in people's faces all the time.
Kind of along these lines, so some industries are a little more set up to have that person speak up on behalf of a movement. Sports is in that, I mean, especially the NBA and the NFL. I want to read some statistics on this a Washington Post article that I found, and its author is Martellus Bennett, who's a former NFL player. He's talking about the role of sports in developing Black children's dreams and how really disproportionate it is to other things.
Like, they don't dream about being doctors, or
they don't dream, exactly.
Yeah.
So, and the percentages are incredibly poor in as far as who can make it to the level of, let's just say, for the NBA.
Oh yeah.
So these are interesting statistics here. High school senior players who go on to play NCAA men's basketball, less than 1 in 35, so 2.9%. So that means that's just from if you were able to make your high school team. NCAA senior players drafted by an NBA team, less than 1 in 75. So once you get to that point, you're at 1.3. High school senior players eventually drafted by an NBA team, so maybe a little bit wider spectrum there, about 3 in 10,000.
If you're not at one of these schools, too, like, well, for football, like Alabama, you know, yeah, that's why some, you know, college sports is so huge and people really, you know, try to get to these schools with great sports programs, because I guess they're like, if I make the team, I'm almost guaranteed I'm going to go pro if I don't hurt
myself. But you're not, based on these statistics.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. You know, it doesn't matter, because it's the percentages are very, very low.
That is, I watch that at schools all the time. Yeah, I think a lot of people will make their choice on college because they love a sport and they want to keep playing it. And they're extending, maybe with the knowledge that they're not going to go to a higher level. They just want to continue to play that sport. Most normal people who live in the world have an understanding that that's going to be the end of it.
Right.
I don't think that's necessarily the carrot that is dangled in, especially for like NBA or those type of athletes. I think athletics are, if you are a black male and you either, you look a certain way, like if you're big, either thick, or if you're tall, there will be an automatic assumption that you're an athlete. Now, that would probably be true with anybody that's tall, but disproportionately to a black young person, would there be an assumption that they are some kind of athlete, and probably more towards basketball than other things, if that's the case. You've had your own experiences with this, even as you're telling about getting stopped in Costco, right?
I had an experience not even probably just a couple weeks ago where, you know, we're all wearing masks. So I actually have a little bit of gray facial hair, but you can't see it because I have a mask on, and I'm pushing a cart around. And for those of you who don't know what I look like, I'm like right shy of 6 feet and over 240 pounds. So, you know, I look like I maybe could have played football. My point is that this older gentleman stopped me in Costco. Well, he said to me, "We could use a guy like you down at Auburn." And I was like, "Excuse me?" He's like, "What college did you go to?" And I said, "Montevallo." He's like, "We could use a guy like you down at Auburn." I was like, "Sir, I'm almost 50. And I think my eligibility has run out." And he just kind of looked at me perplexed and was like, "Well, anyway, War Eagle." And I was just like, "What is wrong with people?"
I've heard this from other people, friends who have said, just big black men, and they never played sports, and people will tell them that they were like, "Oh, you played for Alabama, didn't you?" And he'd be like, no, I didn't play. And eventually he'd just be like, "You know what? Yeah, I was 94, number 94.
Yeah, you remember that? Remember that game against Tennessee?
Uh-huh. And they'd be like, yep. I mean, because there's not a lot of other context for that in people's heads.
And it's so offensive. Did I tell you about the time down at the BP? Some guys behind me, we're like, "Man, I think that's Bo Jackson." Dude, I'm nowhere near as wide as Bo Jackson, but it's like, you know, larger black guy, bald head. They're like, "Man, you look just like..." I'm like, "I don't look anything like Bo Jackson. We're not the same skin tone. We're not..."
Right.
It's just like, that is so offensive. And I said it to him. I was like, "Man, that's racist." "No, it ain't."
We're giving you a compliment.
It's not a compliment. I've had people call me, "Hey, big guy." And I think they're doing it as an endearing thing, but like, it's not a compliment to... point out someone's physical characteristics and automatically judge them to be suitable for competition.
I think that the reason for that, a lot of it, is because of the context of where we see most people succeeding. And so they may not be thinking of it as a negative association, but it's a stereotype, becomes a stereotype. And the statistics on the rest of the world, the tech industry is less than 8% black.
Right. I don't see Asian people and go, "Hey, smart guy," or white people and go, hey, farmer, hey, construction worker.
Well, to the point of people that are white, there's such a wider spectrum of where you see white people.
That's what I'm saying,
succeeding.
Man. I don't automatically think, "Oh, you have a truck and therefore you must be in agriculture." Because, I mean, honestly, when I lived up north, I don't remember seeing many people with pickup trucks. That was a new phenomenon to me when I moved down here.
Yeah, I don't know why people have way more truck than they need down here. They literally don't. They don't even put like boards in their truck from Lowe's. It's just, they're just luxury. It's
hillbilly Cadillac, man.
But so 8% in the tech industry, 6% of doctors are black.
Only 6%.
Only 2% of teachers are black men.
That's statistics for now.
This is in that same Washington Post article, and I mentioned this earlier. 5% of Hollywood's director.
So what are black people doing? Where do we work? Like, what are our jobs?
Well, you're working in a lot of places and you end up in a lot of places, but the carrot that is dangled in front of, and I think the point of this article is not these, like, so my kids, which are fairly typical, you know, middle-class white kids, I don't put a whole lot of weight in their success. I want them to, as long as they're enjoying it, I want them to do well. But we have been very clear from the very beginning, like, look, everything is stacked against you statistically. The chances, and if you're going to be a superstar, then there's stuff that I can do to help that. But there's a lot of things that were already in place with you prior to me getting there. So look, I want you to look around. What do you enjoy doing? Do you enjoy cooking? Do you enjoy building? Like, let's figure out some other things. And frankly, for me, I can look at it and say, you know what? If my kids end up with what we have right here, then that's a success,
right?
Which is true. I think the where this falls apart is that I have a more privileged experience. I'm in a higher class than the majority of Black people or minorities,
I know,
especially.
Right. I am too.
I think when we're talking about, hey, what can you be? What are the options for what you can aspire to? It's more of a like lottery situation. Like I want to get out of, Chappelle has a bit like,
Black
if you want to get out, you better learn how to dance.
Yeah,
you better learn
how to sing, dance.
Yeah. And I think because the whatever average occupations are not presented as, you know, whether that's, I don't think that's a parent thing. I think that's just a cultural
thing. It's a societal thing. Yeah.
Like, the way out is to succeed in something like athletics.
Part of it is like we're measuring success based on superstardom. I'm like you, like if my kids achieve the same level of living that I'm at right now, my wife and I, to me, that's being a success. You know, but our culture is so celebrity driven. It's the culture of celebrity and the whole voyeurism of just like knowing everybody's like what everybody's doing and being high profile, that for a lot of people who aren't just, you know, living kind of average middle class lives like we are, you're either going to be a baller at the top or you're going to be nobody.
There's not a conversation middle. Of like, yeah, there's a whole world in between those things that is a more like there's so many. My kids could take a step up by being like, I want to be a doctor. Like nobody in my family's ever made that decision, but they could take a step up from where they are, but they also could take a lateral step in pretty much any field.
Yes.
and make a good living and be and live essentially the standard in the way and repeat what's been done to them, because that's what did happen before me. You know, that's what my family did, and that's different versions, but that's what they did before them. That again is like a generational privilege, I think.
I am a benefactor of that, but I'm like the maybe first or second generation in my family to be a beneficiary.
Yeah, you're
of
the
that.
Beginning of that. In your
yeah,
family.
Because like my pastor said to me the other day, like you've pretty much been middle class your whole life. Because I was relating to him a story about, you know, just like my first car and all of that. And he's just like, you've been middle class your whole life, haven't you? I'm like, well, yeah. I was like, but I think it was because I was born 9 years after my oldest brother. And I think by that time, my parents had kind of accrued a little wealth and were able to give me maybe more material things and present more opportunities to me than a lot of Black kids my age.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe if we'd been born like right after one another, the resources may not have been there. The fact that I'm a professional musician, it never escapes me that I'm like, this is something that you were able to pursue and do because you came from a background that allowed you, like you said, to make that choice. You didn't have to choose working in the steel mill or starving. Nothing wrong working. I had plenty of relatives that worked in steel mills and sawmills and made good livings and took care of their families. But the ability to be able to make a choice to be an artist is or was kind of frowned upon, not just in Black families, but just kind of like in our culture in general. But for Black people, it's like, you need to get a good job. That's what I always heard growing up. Like, you need to go to school so you can get a good job. Like, but what is a good job? That doesn't exist in our society anymore, does it? In this economy, like a job is a good job, just any job. The emphasis that people place on being super rich and famous and like ballers, you know, it's so inundated in urban culture through the music and through just sports entertainment that like you said, kids don't see like, oh, well, I could become like, you know, a chef and like have a really, you know, nice, you know, life. They think that they got to go to the majors or go to the NBA.
Isn't this perpetuated by people seeing these people who stand out in these different fields, whether it's in hip hop or whether it's in sports, and they did come up from nothing and they kind of got out of a situation because they focused on this one thing and they excelled in this one thing, or they practiced this, or they forgot everything else and kind of, not everything else, but with sports, it can be like that because you kind of have to focus on sports.
Right.
They chased after this thing that without realizing the unlikelihood of them actually being able to reach that, even if they were good. And so the other things just weren't participated in or practiced in ways that ever gave them another option out of that.
That's true, because environment plays a huge part in self-actualization. So if all you see in your environment the people that are successful in your environment. Like, you know, for us growing up, we saw teachers and lawyers and managers of, you know, different places. So that was normal to us. But if you're a kid from a neighborhood that's more impoverished or less well-to-do, and so who do you see in your neighborhood that's doing great? You see the people on TV, of course, like the 1 or 2% of athletes or entertainers. So like, okay, well, maybe I can be a pro ball player or a professional singer. Well, who else? Well, the preacher, you know, in a lot of black neighborhoods, like ministers, black preachers seem to be doing well. Who else you got? You got hustlers, drug dealers, pimps. And so a lot of kids, that's what they're like. Well, if I want to get out of my situation, I can either be a pimp, hustler, entertainer, or preacher. I had people around me my whole life that worked in a variety of different professions. So like your children, I understood like I can do whatever I want. My mother's a school teacher. I had an uncle that was a minister. You know, I had other uncles that worked in factories that were mechanics. I had uncles and aunts that worked at the newspaper. So, I mean, like you said, I was encouraged to learn to see what I had an aptitude for. And I had an aptitude for like literature and books and things of that nature. And I was encouraged to pursue more academic stuff. But then as I got older, I was invested in from my family to pursue music. Not everyone is given that opportunity.
And everyone, regardless of race, is disillusioned by the allure of fame, of being able to accomplish something just because they have a common interest in it. Like, just because I enjoy, you know, it's been the case with me with music in the past. Like, just because I can do a few things, I think, oh, well, my eyes are set on this person who has accomplished great success without realizing the improbability of that. And frankly, without having much of a backup plan for doing that. And so I think that's kind of beyond race in that sense. I do think that the things that can really contribute to that are when you come off of that, what do you have?
Right.
Like when that doesn't work out, what do you have? Or on your way there, what other skills did you gain while you were gaining the skills to do that?
When I started playing music and really was getting more proficient at it, yeah, of course I wanted to be Prince. But then the more that I studied music and got into it and saw what it took, I realized that the odds of me ever achieving that were next to nil.
Mm-hmm.
But it was like that didn't prevent me from continuing to pursue music because I realized there were other avenues that you could make a living being a musician that didn't necessarily translate into being a superstar.
Right.
But that's what people don't understand a lot of times about, especially, I guess, as creatives. People don't see that, like, you don't have to be famous to be successful.
Mm-hmm.
The allure of being famous is so powerful in our day and age that kids, they really don't understand, you know, anything else. I've had my son tell me that he wants to get good at playing video games so he can be on YouTube and make money.
Yeah.
Which I'm like, okay.
That's a good example because that's the next sort of big lottery thing is YouTube star. Or online social media star.
And they don't get that, like, that, right, that that's a very low percentage of people who are able to translate that into actual economic wealth and stability. Not everybody that gets on there is going to be able to do that.
For our moment of levity here, my wife sent me an article just this morning about vinyl. Vinyl has, for the first time since the 80s, has surpassed CD sales, which, you know, I guess depending on when that is in the 80s, that's what, almost 35 years, something like that?
Yeah.
That vinyl would have been king and then it's gone away and now it's come back. It's really remarkable. I think this is not surprising news to anybody, but I think you've done vinyl before. I've done vinyl recently, but it was still something that only like audiophiles or certain people were going to really appreciate and want. Everybody else
known as record geeks.
Yeah, exactly. And maybe they still are. And maybe it's just that CD sales are just really down. But enough people have had to really get into that for that to be a significant change and for it to take over CDs.
The only way you're able to actually make a profit as an artist selling an actual physical medium right now is if you press vinyl.
Have you gone through that process before? Like, have you been the person on the job, or have you been in the bands that have done
I've been
it?
In both.
Because my experience with vinyl, when
it's
I want,
expensive.
It's extremely yeah. expensive. And you have to start with somebody like me. At the time, it was like a minimum of 1,000 in order to start getting the break.
Jeez, that's a lot.
I don't know 15 people who listen to records. Like, I wasn't going to do that option.
Right.
So I had to go with like a single cut, basically a die cut for every album.
Oh, yeah.
And they were all unique in that sense. But the cost to do that was essentially the cost of what someone would pay for an album. So I just did it as a novelty and I just tried to break even. But in order to actually make money to what you're talking about, the margins, you have to be able to sell a lot of those things.
If you're in the music business and you really have enough of a fan base, vinyl makes sense at this day and time.
Because you can charge a lot more for vinyl,
right.
too.
Right. I mean, yeah, the average vinyl record probably is $20-$25.
Right.
Most shows that I've gone to and actually purchased a vinyl, it's been like $25 for a single. Double albums, man, you're getting into $40 and $50 sometimes.
Right.
Some people still have CDs at their shows, but it's usually like vinyl and t-shirts are the big, you know, things at the merch tables.
My experience with CDs, and really ever since the end of my time doing music, like in the early aughts, that was sort of the ending of people like being like, I want your CD so I can go and listen to it. I know some people who still listen to CDs.
I listen to CDs.
For the most part. And I mean, the quality is still the best overall.
That's debatable.
It's not as dynamic, but it's as far as the clarity of it and the...
I think it depends on the genre of music. For classical CDs, to me, always will be, that is the medium for classical music, just because of the nature of the music and the quiet passages and all. You don't have the surface noise. But
right.
like in more pop mediums, jazz, rock, blues, whatever, I prefer vinyl.
I personally would prefer listening to vinyl because it's not as compressed as CDs, correct? Like I like that you actually have to manage the volume on a record. If you're listening to something like classical or something that has very faint parts and then it gets very big, like there would be a much bigger range than just if you're listening to a CD.
Also, I like the ritual aspect to playing vinyl. Like I have all my little stylus cleaners and my little brushes to clean my vinyl and my little record clamps.
You like the work that's involved.
Yeah, it's like I feel like I'm interacting with the music.
That's true. I could see that. It's very physical.
It is. I like that. And I like looking at the covers and the, you know, reading the lyrics.
I know it sounds like really simple things, but they're big enough to actually look at in the artwork to actually
see. Humans are very tactile. We enjoy touching and feeling things. From an economic standpoint, yeah, it makes absolutely no sense to like have a LP or a record player. The most efficient way would probably just to have all MP3 files or whatever.
To stream it.
Yeah, to stream it. And my daughter and I got, my youngest daughter was like, you got another record at the door from Amazon. She's like, we have it on Apple Music. Why can't you just? I'm like, it's not the same. Actually, I rarely listen to music on Apple Music for my enjoyment. I listen to music on Apple Music or Spotify or whatever when I'm in the car, if I'm learning something where I kind of got to keep going back, or on an airplane or something. Like when I'm at my house, I play CDs and records pretty much exclusively.
The convenience is really that's why that's won the day. But it's also interesting that like with the more with subscription base, I look at my library. If I go out of service and I have Apple Music,
don't have access to
I don't have my music anymore. Yeah, exactly. And I don't own those anymore. I'm just paying for a subscription.
See, that's what I don't like. And, you know, I'm also enough of a conspiracy theorist and doomsday prepper that when the grid goes down, I think we're still going to have electricity, but they're going to knock out those satellites, so you ain't going to be able to stream any of that music. And I'm still going to be jamming at my house.
Just be you and
I'll have listening
your
parties.
7,000 albums.
I actually had a dream where the grid was down. This is for real. And that like everybody was like overhanging out in my yard or around because
I was the only king.
I was the king. Oh my gosh. But I could play music. Kids would just come out of the woods like, what is that? Like, it had been long enough. Like, this wasn't like now. It's like I was an old hermit, man. Yeah,
dystopia.
Like, yeah. I had a weird dystopian dream where it was like 40, 50 years in the future. People were like, we heard that you have music.
We heard you had Crack Rear View by Hootie and the Blowfish.
And I was like, I gave that one to Corey.
You needed to learn some songs.
I laid that one to Corey still has, but I have the complete Rush catalog on vinyl.
I think it's pretty fascinating, and I think it's encouraging in a lot of ways. I think that it's going to meet its limit here soon because I just don't think enough people are going to get back into that medium to make it what it used to be.
But they're going for all, they're getting out of it all they can right now, man. Like, record players are so overpriced for what they actually do.
That's the thing, when you get into a niche like that,
yeah, well,
people will pay for it who are interested in it.
I've definitely gone down that rabbit hole a bit myself. But I mean, what can the actual human ear hear at a certain point? I can only hear so much. So many hertz and decibels. And so, like, do I really need this $500 cartridge? No. And so I don't get it. I get the $79 one.
Uh-huh.
And I'm like, man, this record sounds fine.
That gets to what your tuner is, and that gets into what
your amplifier
speakers are.
Your speakers, yeah. I mean,
how much noise you have coming through those.
I got
how much it colors it.
Oh, yeah. I have 4 record player setups through different speakers, different amps, and they all sound a little different to me. But at the end of the day, I'm like, it's a piece of wax with a fake diamond running over it.
Not a real diamond?
No, they are what they call commercial diamonds.
Blood diamonds?
They are not the blood. Yeah, like my record player has a $40,000 blood diamond. That's why my music sounds so good.
Oh, that's a really dark way to end this. All right, well, we'll all come over to your house when the world falls apart, and we will relive or live out that nightmare that you had, which is not really a nightmare. It's really your moment of glory in the end after you're an old man, when you become king.
When Jesse rules the world.
You'll be the vinyl king.
And that'll be the first song I'll play is Tears for Fears, Everybody Wants to Rule the World. But only I will be ruling, because I actually have the vinyl of that.
All right, man. Well, good talk. Love you, man.
Love you, Corey.